When energy dips, your reviving routine deserves more than a quick fix. Reach for Vital Proteins Collagen and Protein Shake in chocolate. With 30 grams of protein and 10 grams of collagen peptides, it helps support healthy hair, skin, nails, and joints in a smooth, ready-to-drink shake. So your afternoon reset actually sets you up for success. Vital Proteins. Stay vital. Visit vitalproteins.com to get started. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. These products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This is Sarah Spain from Good Game with Sarah Spain, brought to you in part by Vital Farms. Let me tell you why Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs are the only eggs I have in my fridge. The hens. They're living the good life. Fresh air, sunshine, and wide open pastures. I use my Vital Farms for my famous frittatas. And you could trace your eggs back to the farm they came from. Check the carton for the farm name, pop it into vitalfarms.com/farm, and boom, you're looking at the pasture. So next time you're in the store, look for the black carton in the egg aisle and visit vitalfarms.com to learn more. Vital Farms. Good eggs. No shortcuts.
It's said everything happens for a reason, but maybe everything happens for a Reese's. Take noise-canceling headphones. Do they block hearing to heighten taste? That sound seems to show everything happens for a Reese's.
Today on The Grave Talks, Rough Waters, the ghosts of Upper Michigan.
Young man Brad Blair and his friends would wander the back roads of Michigan's Upper Peninsula, seeking out scares and thrills in old abandoned farmhouses. Brad, along with his friends, would enter the rickety properties with a Ouija board in tow and attempt to make contact with spirits. Sometimes having success, others not. Years after these teenage adventures, Brad decided to take his love of ghost hunting to a more serious and professional level and formed the UPRS, or the Upper Peninsula Paranormal Research Society. With this group, Brad would soon uncover many very real and untold ghost stories of the desolate land known as Michigan's Upper Peninsula.
You hear all of these people, especially paranormal investigators, talk about how they grew up in a haunted house, or they saw Grandma walk across the hallway one day when they were at their aunt's house and Grandma had been dead for 5 years, or they had some big event that really brought the paranormal into their lives. That wasn't the case for me. I just grew up in a small town in northern Michigan, and we're in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, which, if you're not familiar with it, we're referred to as UPRS, mm-hmm. because it's the UP, and it's really kind of a different lifestyle here altogether. It's the UP makes up about a third of Michigan's landmass, but only about 3% or so of the state's population total lives in the UP. So there's a lot of outdoors activities. There is, nature's a big thing. And I grew up in a family that my dad was big into hunting and doing all this outdoor stuff. And it never really appealed a lot to me. I like being out in the woods. I'm not a homebody by any means, but I always, the hunting, the fishing, I understood the appeal of it, but it wasn't a real hobby or a fascination for me. I always kind of liked the strange and the abnormal. And on Saturdays, I would sit home in the afternoon, and this was back when we only had 12 television channels, so you knew when your favorite shows were going to be on, and Creature Feature would be aired out of a Detroit TV station every Saturday at 3 o'clock, and I always caught that because it was usually the only chance for a horror show at any time outside of the October season. So I kind of weaned into it a little bit like that. And when I was in first grade, I met two of my best friends, Tim Ellis and Steve LaPlante, who long ways down the line, we would co-found our group, the Upper Peninsula Paranormal Research Society. But this was back when we were kids, and these two were freaks like me. They really liked the strange, the bizarre. When the other kids were out playing soccer or basketball during recess, we were telling ghost stories, and we'd get on our bikes and ride to the local library. This is we're talking late 70s, early 80s, so way before the internet was even thought of. So we'd go to the library at least twice a week. We'd be pedaling down, and any book on the strange, the bizarre, be it mainly ghosts, was always the big fascination. But yeah, Bigfoot, UFOs, any other type of cryptids, unsolved murders, that kind of thing that makes your parents sit and stare at you and wonder what the hell's wrong with you, were what we were into. And we'd check these books out over and over again, and it just really, really built up the fascination, I guess, from a young age. And then we got into the high school age and got the car and the driver's license, and we could take off and we'd go explore. And being in the UP, like I said, you really didn't have to worry about, you know, people following you around or, you know, high crime. It's a very low crime area, very laid back. But there's a lot of old farmhouses that had been established back in the 1800s that were now abandoned but still standing. So our thing, we called it spooking. We would get, and there were usually a few other kids from school, they'd join in with us, and it got to be kind of a cult following that we had where, hey, are you guys going out spooking this weekend? Can we come with you? And yeah, you know, absolutely. We'll end up taking two cars. So we're 10 miles out of town in an old farm field and Ouija board under one arm. And if somebody remembered a flashlight, they were in the lead. So we would go into these houses and have our little impromptu seances. We'd do that with old abandoned cemeteries as well in the area, which nowadays, of course, we advise people against for so many reasons, outside of being mainly illegal and trespassing. There's always the issues with some of these old homes we went into. Nobody really should have been in just because of the hazards of them falling apart and falling in on themselves. So that was really kind of the start, I guess. It was more of a group thing. And once I had people that my friends, like I said, Tim and Steve, and get these other people along that would come in and show an interest in the paranormal and all things odd and strange, that really fueled the fire that just kept going and saying, hey, maybe there's something more to this than just scary stories or that Saturday afternoon creature feature. Maybe there's more to this whole paranormal ghost field where our parents were telling us, there's, you know, this is nothing. It's all superstition. You know, just get out of that stuff. We don't want you dealing with it. Well, of course, being teenagers, that just pushed us further and further into that rabbit hole.
In those years, those teenage years of exploring and going out there, and just the atmosphere is what makes it for you as a teenager. Even if nothing happens, being out wandering the desolate the roads of Upper Michigan, mm-hmm. and wandering. I grew up in Wisconsin, in Northeast Wisconsin. I worked in Traverse City and Petoskey in Michigan several years ago, so I know the area well. And went through the UP many a times, and I even have a near-death story up there we'll talk about a little bit later. I have to ask, when you're out there as a teenager and you're doing your spooking, as you called it, going into the old mm-hmm. abandoned farmhouses with a Ouija board and doing impromptu seances as a novice teenager with something like that, did you ever have anything happen other than just getting creeped out because of what was going on?
We did, as a matter of fact, and that's not a lot, because it was there were always two or three girls with us, and they'd get a little scared, a little off on it, and I'm not saying some of the guys didn't either, but we always put on the macho front and be, come on, let's go, let's get out of here. We had one experience that even this far down the road sticks out very vividly. We were in an old cemetery with the Ouija board, and it was dark, and we just decided to sit down on an old grave that was from, I want to say, the late 1700s, early 1800s. And we started doing this session on the Ouija board. And all of a sudden, we started, you know, and you always take the Ouija with a grain of salt, but it started moving, and it started spelling out these letters. And we looked, and we said, well, whose grave are we on anyway? So the guy with the flashlight came over and kind of shined down. And the first three letters that had spelled out were the exact as they were on the tombstone. Now, whether or not the other person with me had already seen that, I had not. But as soon as we broke contact, there was this deep, eerie moan that came from the woods directly behind us. And you want to talk about seeing a group of kids hightail it the hell out of an area. because this is literally the middle of nowhere. There's no houses around here. There's no street lights. They don't use this cemetery. Haven't for many years. So we booked it out of there pretty quick. And another occasion, I guess, that we had something happen. We were in one of these old farmhouses, and it was Devil's Night. We had a big tradition by our senior year of high school. I want to say we probably had 3 carloads of people that would come along because they all knew we were doing this. And it got out there too much so, as you'll see, that we did this every Devil's Night. And there were certain houses that we'd had some strange experiences with lights on the car that would go dead on us, the car's electric system going dead, and strange things when we'd pull into this one area. So the group gets in, and we're going through, and I'm still in the bottom floor of the house, and I could hear people walking up the attic stairway. Now, there's no windows in this house, but there's still old appliances, wood stove, old ice box that's rotted out in there. It's very, very creepy. Think the cabin from Blair Witch Project. And you're in the middle of nowhere. There's some stuff laying around. And so we're going through, and all of a sudden, I hear yelling coming from the upstairs. And here comes the rest of the crew running top speed down the steps, tripping over each other. Get out, get out. I said, well, shit. So, excuse me. So I turn around and run, and we're going down this drive that we had to leave the cars out towards the end of the road. It was so overgrown. We're running down, and I said, what happened? What happened? There's somebody in the attic with a baseball bat that they just swung. And I said, wait a minute. That's, a little too out there. So everybody keeps running to the cars, and we get there, and I look down the road a little ways, and I see my brother's truck creeping out. Him and one of his friends knew we were going there. They laid in wait for I don't know how long just to scare the hell out of us. So, after that, we learned the lesson. You don't ever tell anybody where you're going.
It's sometimes the living that can be more scary than the dead in those sort of
often.
Cases. Yes, very much so. That's one of the haunting things, and I want to help paint the picture for the audience that has never been to Upper Michigan, because unless you have a reason to transfer between Lower Michigan and Canada or Wisconsin, there's very few reasons that you're going to travel through Upper Michigan.
Right.
So a lot of folks don't even realize it exists, which is kind of funny, I find.
It gets left off a lot of maps, it turns out, on different promotions. We just had a Mountain Dew left one off. There was just something else I saw this week. I think it was something on NBC. They forgot about us. So
it's funny.
We're kind of Michigan's bastard child.
Yeah,
if you will.
It's funny that Wisconsin doesn't end and touch Canada. There is a piece there called Upper Michigan that is right there.
Right.
It's a very interesting place. To me, it's one of the most scenically beautiful areas of the country. As a child, I was just blown away when we took a family vacation and drove around the lake, did the Badger, the boat across Lake Michigan, and then went around.
Sure.
And I was just, I loved it. I love the Upper Michigan. I love the beauty of it. But in winter, when it's tourist season is off and it's snow and it's even more desolate than it already is, it can be very haunting. I had one point in my life, when I was working in the Petoskey Traverse City market, when I was doing radio, I had to get back into Wisconsin for a funeral. And the quickest route to me seemed to go through Upper Michigan rather than go south. And I had to do this in a snowstorm, or essentially a blizzard with all the lake effect, because you're essentially driving along Lake Michigan along a lot of the ways. And I swear to God, I had a two-wheel drive Ford Taurus, probably a 92 model or something. And
not
I don't
really built for winter.
Oh, God. I don't know how I survived. I mean, I have a truck now, four-wheel drive, and that thing gets stuck in snow sometimes. I have no idea how on earth I made it through Upper Michigan that day, because I did. There was areas where you could not see the road. Literally, you couldn't tell where the road was. You only knew that by the patch of trees to your right and to your left, there was a road somewhere in that area. And there was also, hills and drop-offs and all of this. I somehow made it, and I there was no place to stop. Every place was closed. It was one of the scariest times I've ever been through Upper Michigan. Took me 14 hours to drive the UP end to end, but I did it. And to this day, I when I got out of that car, I said I'm lucky to be alive after that one, because I could have easily slid off and been stuck, and there's nobody coming for a long, long time. But back to more of the paranormal things in your area. You obviously, you explored these old farmhouses, you investigated ghost stories and just kind of the local stuff that was going on around you. As you got older, right, and then you, you're connecting with your old high school friends, and you're digging into this deeper, going, you know, let's look at this a little more seriously than just wandering out to the old farmhouse to get creeped out with some girls. What did you, what was the inspiration for that later, as you got older, to dig into this on a more serious level?
Well, we all came back, somehow or another, we all ended up in Sault Ste. Marie, mm-hmm, which is our hometown, after college.
Sure.
And Tim, the co-founder of the group with me, got a job at a local radio station, and we'd still been, you know, we were all very close friends still, and we were getting together all the time, and we'd always talk about the ghost hunting. And, you know, keep in mind, this is prior to the explosion of reality television, when ghost hunters and ghost adventures kind of blew the door wide open. So the paranormal as a field was still pretty taboo. You had October, the month of October, where you could turn on the TV and see shows about ghost hunting, and usually it'd be Ed and Lorraine Warren or Hans Holzer that would be on doing an interview on some daytime talk show. But there was very little out there year round. So, you know, it was still very much in the closet, so to speak, as far as the whole field was. But we said, you know, let's, Tim was working at this radio station, and we'd been talking about forming or getting in under another group, which there weren't many of back then. We're talking still mid to late 90s here. And Tim had this idea that he said, hey, my boss is good with this. I want to find a local home or business that has a reputation for being haunted, that has a good backstory to it. And I want to do a live ghost investigation from the place. So, like, absolutely, let's do this. So Tim got on air and started soliciting for a place to go and do this overnight investigation at. And at the time, as I said, it wasn't as open of a field. So we got a handful of people, though, that said, yeah, why don't you come here? Why don't you come here? You, as usual, and we still get these from time to time, well, you guys need to investigate this public building or this location, but they have no ties to management or ownership or anyone to get us in legally. So sure, we settled on an old historic home that had servants' quarters to the back of the stairs, and they'd sent us a picture, and they hadn't moved into the house yet. It was the front of the home, and you can see the silhouette of what looks to be a small child standing in the upstairs window. So that was their first clue that something was going on here. And we ended up talking to one of our other friends from school that was still in town, not associated with us in this endeavor. But he said, God, he said, I grew up in that house. He said, yeah, it's haunted. He said, we always had things being moved around. The family's complaints that called us were, you know, dishes being moved in the kitchen, cupboard doors open, and they started to see this young boy. So we said, yeah, absolutely. We want to do this. We want to set up. And at the time, we had a couple of the old clunky cassette recorders with the microphone. We borrowed big VHS cameras that we could walk around and record with from friends and family. We had this big, huge bowl parabolic microphone that we took with us, which I don't know what the hell we thought we were catching with that, but we had it. So it looked like we had equipment. That was the main thing. And we ended up going into this house, and we started hearing things. We were upstairs, and we started hearing a door banging. I went down to check. Well, it was nothing paranormal. It was going back to not telling anybody where you're going to be. This family had literally invited friends and family over to come and watch the ghost hunters perform. So there's all these people gathered around in the living room, and they were very nice people. They'd laid out a big buffet for us. We had chili, hot dogs, everything waiting when we got there. And we were there from, I believe that one ran from 11 at night until 6 in the morning. And it was a very, very long night. We finally got rid of some of their friends, and nothing happened. as is often the case. But we really got the taste then. This was our first time going out there and presenting ourselves as semi-professional paranormal people. So after this, we kept talking about wanting to keep this going. And as it is now, we just did our 20th annual. We've done this every year the night before Halloween. We did our 20th annual radio show live from a location. Now we go in and do it usually 9 till midnight, sometime when people are actually awake and listening. That's still going to this day. But that really wet our whistle, and we started looking into organizations. And back then, I think we found 2 in the entire state of Michigan. Now you've got 2 in every town.
Sure.
And they were both down by the Detroit area, which is a 5-hour drive from where we're at.
Mm-hmm.
And we reached out, and we didn't hear anything back from either, but we just wanted to get somebody to kind of mentor us. I mean, we'd read and studied this literally since elementary school. So we had some understanding of what we thought was an understanding at the time of the paranormal field, but we just wanted somebody to go to that we could throw questions to and get insight from. And we were kind of hitting a brick wall, and we finally found an organization in Ontario, which was called the Ontario Ghost and Haunting Research Society, I believe. And they had nothing in Northern Ontario, where we're right next to, literally a 5-minute drive to. And they said, yeah, we would love to hook up with you guys if you wouldn't mind coming across the bridge and investigating claims that we get up that way. And yeah, they'd been established for, and I say established, for about 2 years at the time that we got under them, but they had those 2 years above us. So we worked with them for a couple of years, and we didn't do a lot with them. And we found that it was just better off to do our own thing, so we weren't going back and answering to somebody else and people that we honestly never met and still never have to this day. And this is, you know, 20 some years back. So that was right around 2000 that we decided to put our own team out there. And that's when the UPRS, UPPRS, was formed.
Not to be confused with the musical group that, if you are in the area, you'll have heard of, the UPRS.
Absolutely not. I know those guys, and I'm very fond of them. But no, absolutely nothing to do with those guys.
Yes, completely different. And there's there's a very small sect of our audience that even knows what we're talking about.
I if any.
Oh, we have listeners all over. We have a lot in Michigan. I know that. So let me ask you, when you did kind of break off and you started kind of doing your own thing around 2000, and how did that go? When people started to reach out and say, hey, I would like you to come take a look at this. Obviously, and I understand with this field, you're going to get a lot of cases and people who really, there's no haunting going on whatsoever. It's either something that's completely explainable, or there's a mental illness going on or something of that nature that really is not going to be helped by ghost investigating. But let's talk about the ones that were legitimate once you dug into it.
Right.
And you discovered, yeah, there's something going on here. What was that first case for you that you guys dug into that really made you go, wow, this is, you know, it kind of brought back that initial excitement, that initial wow factor that you had back in that old farmhouse as a teenager?
Right. Well, it was, we were lucky, I guess, with the fact that we had what some people perceived as some credibility because of the radio show. And we'd been, the first 2 years, we did maybe 2 cases a year. And like you said, it was people that just thought their house was haunted. One case, it was kind of sad, honestly. It was an older lady that her husband had passed away, and she was certain that he was coming back and waking her up every night between 2 and 3 in the morning by shaking the bed. And we went in, and this lady's house was a paranormal dream. She had formerly owned an antique store and had a lot of these different, I don't know how far back, trinkets, different things, lining her living room. In one corner of the living room was her husband's urn with his ashes in it. The other corner was her mother's urn with her ashes in it. So we're like, well, if there's any legitimacy to an attachment haunting, there's a pretty good chance we're going to hit something here. So we went in and set up and had absolutely nothing, no readings of any kind. Nothing was going on. We sat all night and it was getting late. And she was in her 70s, I would guess. And we said, well, we don't want to keep you up. It's already midnightish. But do you mind if we record you when you sleep and we can see what's going on? Because that's your number one complaint to us. No problem. So we set it up, and this was about an hour away from our hometown. So we had to get up the next day. We let our cameras run all night, and we had to get up the next day and go back and break everything down and take it back. Well, one of our guys on the team is a physical therapist by trade and has some, you know, information in the medical field. We were reviewing it, and he looked, and he said, well, she has restless leg syndrome. He said, it's a textbook case. Her leg was raising up, and it was sometime between 2 and 3 in the morning and slammed down. And then it kind of, she'd roll around a little and the same thing would happen. And then we saw her wake up and it startled herself awake. So we sat down with her and showed her the video, and we said, oh, sorry, ma'am, but this is, I don't think it's your husband. I think this is what it is. And you should probably consult a physician, and they can probably give you some medication or whatever, you know, but talk to your healthcare provider. Well, no, that's not it. Well, this is exactly what you reported to us, ma'am. No, it's my husband. I don't know why you guys would say this. And it was kind of the don't take away my ghost feeling. Sure. She was so set in her mind that this was her husband coming to wake her up at night and just to acknowledge that he's still there. And that's, we learned really quick after that you have to be very careful when you're revealing to people, even if it's not paranormal. And sometimes, especially when it's not paranormal, which normally is the case, that they can take great offense if you're debunking their haunting. Mm-hmm. So that was, you know, something we learned early on. As far as a case that really, I think, busted things wide open, and we never would have gotten into this location if it had not been for the radio connections. There's a lighthouse on Northern Lake Michigan called Sechua Point, and the French translation for it is literally Only Choice. And this is in a little cove area off of Northern Lake Michigan. And the old voyageurs, the French fur traders, when they came through this route, that was the only place they could duck in if a storm was coming up, hence Only Choice, Sechua. And if they didn't, they had very little chance of making it to the next stop before they would get overturned by the storms coming in. So this lighthouse is down the end of this winding dirt road. You turn off and you're heading down, and you see a few houses in a little village area of Gulliver, Michigan, and then you get past that and there's nothing but trees on both sides. And you get down to the lighthouse, and you're driving through this route of dirt road and trees, and all of a sudden there's a clearing, and it literally hits you out of the blue. There's this huge, beautiful, historic lighthouse there, and you've got the waves rolling in the background, and it's a beautiful location. But once it gets dark, it's also creepy as hell. So they were on one of the old reality, quote unquote, reality shows before the big ghost hunting shows. It was with Linda Blair. I want to say it was maybe Scariest Places on Earth, but they'd film there. It had always had a reputation of being haunted. And the main culprit in the haunting is Captain Joseph Willie Townsend, who was a former lightkeeper. And he had been there in the late 1800s to the early 1900s, I believe it was. And he wasn't a well-liked man in the area. He was from England, and he ended up transferring over. He had a career as a fisherman, ended up working light on Mackinac Island at one point, and then ended up transferred to Sechua by the lighthouse service. And the locals kind of thought that was a title, the position that should have been given to a local person. You know, they didn't want an outsider coming in. This was a tight little fishing village. Mm-hmm. So the captain wasn't really well liked off the bat. But he ran the rest of his tenure there, and he ended up dying in the lighthouse. There's a sink in the basement that they claim he was embalmed in that still sits there now, which adds to the creep factor because it's an old cement basement. And you look at that and you just can picture this old man that had withered away from consumption, that was being embalmed in this sink.
Yeah.
And the people that run it, I should say the Gulliver Historical Society, Marilyn Fisher, the head of it, great people, and they love the hauntings. They embrace this. In fact, Marilyn wrote a book on it. I believe it's just Hauntings of Sishua Point. But they love the captain, but the captain's not the only ghost. They also reported smelling perfume and seeing a woman appear in a mirror at one point that had this big old fluff hat on and a little dog by her. But there were a lot of women that had lived there that were keepers' wives, mother-in-laws, and they kind of whittled it down to a few people they think the other ghosts are. But the captain's the main one. Reason being, the captain was a big cigar smoker, and his wife never let him smoke in the house. So he always had to go outside whenever he wanted to enjoy, and he liked cheap cigars. He wasn't going after the Cubans by any means. He preferred a Swisher Sweet or something cheap that he could just, if he got half of it done and had to snuff out, he could toss. So they started smelling when they started remodeling the lighthouse one year, when they were opening it up to the public for the first time. They started to smell cigar smoke. And this ended up being in conjunction with hearing footsteps different places. And it just, they kind of got creeped out a little bit at first. But they decided that it was likely the captain who was checking out on what they were doing, what was going on with his light. And then they started having an experience with a Bible. It was actually Captain Townsend's old Bible that was put out in the dining room on this big stand. And he had a favorite Bible verse, and it's always open to that. And people started flipping through, and they'd just leave it on whatever page it was on. So if it was left to that page, they would come in the next morning and the whole Bible would be closed if it wasn't left to the page of his favorite verse. So they started coming in, and this ended up being a regular occurrence. They would come in the day, they would set the alarm when they left at night, come back in the morning, and the Bible's closed. But they determined, because it was well known what his favorite Bible verse was, it had been marked in the Bible, it was his Bible. And so they figured out if they leave it on that page, it never moves. And then the other tipping point to kind of bring the captain into it as the main haunting culprit, the captain was from England originally. The English set their tables, at least they did back then. I don't know nowadays, but they have a different place setting where they have the forks turned with the prongs down. Well, they started coming in the mornings, and this place is set up like somebody is living there. You walk in, and there's a kitchen, there's a dining room, there's desks, a piano, a whole living area. So they would come in the morning, they would leave at night, and the table would be set in your typical American fashion. They would come in the next morning and find the place settings, the silverware, turned upside down. So they wrapped all this together, and somebody came to the conclusion it had to be the captain. So that's who we were going to find. We were going to find Captain Townsend, and this was our first big investigation that we were being welcomed in to this historical museum to try and find out what was going on there. So we got in, we're setting up our equipment, and we're still fairly green at the time. We'd been doing this, getting a couple investigations a year, because most people back then still wouldn't talk about it if they had activity. And we landed this. So this was going to be a big deal. So we got everything set up, and we had a local psychic sensitive man that was with us, who's on the board for the Historical Society. So we have our equipment's out, and there's a few of us doing the walkthrough, and we get up into the captain's bedroom. Now, there's a mirror in the bedroom that they claim the captain appears in from time to time. It's not a clear visage by any means, but kind of a smoky haze that forms into the figure of a man's head with a beard. And the psychic that's with us said, "Wait a minute." He said, "Somebody's here with us. Someone's touching my shoulder." So I had a laser thermometer with me at the time, and I checked his shoulder, and it was around 7-8 degrees colder than the rest of his body when I moved it across, which was odd, right where he was pointing to. And all of a sudden, the batteries start to go dead in some of our equipment.
That wraps up part one of our interview with Brad Blair. Be sure to check out Brad's book, Youpernatural Haunts. Y-O-O-P-E-R, natural is how that's spelled. Youpernatural Haunts, available on Amazon and wherever books are sold. In part two, we're going to continue this story and find out if Brad and his ghost hunting crew made contact with the ghost captain, Captain Townsend, at the haunted lighthouse, and what happened when him and his crew lit and smoked cigars in honor of the deceased captain. And why is it that lighthouses commonly seem to be such haunted locations? What kind of spirits live along the area known as Shipwreck Point in Upper Michigan? And did a spirit of the Edmunds Fitzgerald make contact with the ghost hunting team at a very famous shipwreck museum in Michigan's Upper Peninsula? And we ask the question, are there more ghosts in desolate areas like Michigan's Upper Peninsula than a more densely populated area? Or is it just the fact that it's quieter, it's more tranquil, and the spirits of the dead are much more evident in such settings? It's a part of pure Michigan that you may have never heard before. To hear it, become a gravekeeper that is a supporter of our program. Sign up to be one through our website at patreon.com/thegravetalks or directly through thegravetalks.com. Click Become a Gravekeeper. For $5 a month, you'll have access to the rest of this episode, as well as access to part two of all of our episodes. And you'll get advanced episodes of our programs weeks before they're released to the public, oftentimes months before they're released to the public. All commercial free. Patreon.com/thegravetalks or thegravetalks.com. Click Become a Gravekeeper. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening. Did you hear it in the wind? Did you fear it once again? Did you see it closing in?
They say everything happens for a reason, but I suspect everything happens for a reason. Like this commercial break. Did you need 15 seconds away from music? Or 15 seconds to eat a Reese's? Perhaps it's true. Everything happens for a reason. They say everything happens for a reason, but I suspect
Everything happens for a reason. Like this commercial break. Did you need 15 seconds away from music? Or 15 seconds to eat a Reese's? Perhaps it's true. Everything happens for a Reese's. They say everything happens for a reason, but I suspect everything happens for a Reese's. Like this commercial break. Did you need 15 seconds away from music? Or 15 seconds to eat a Reese's? Perhaps it's true. Everything happens for a Reese's. It's said everything happens for a reason, but maybe everything happens for a Reese's. Take noise-canceling headphones. Do they block hearing to heighten taste? That sound seems to show everything happens for a Reese's.
Struggling to see up close? Make it visible with Viz. Viz is a once-daily prescription eye drop to treat blurry near vision for up to 10 hours. The most common side effects that may be experienced while using Viz include eye irritation, temporary dim or dark vision, headaches, and eye redness. Talk to an eye doctor to learn if Viz is right for you. Learn more at Viz.com.
They say everything happens for a reason, but I suspect everything happens for a Reese's. Like this commercial break. Did you need 15 seconds away from music? Or 15 seconds to eat a Reese's? Perhaps it's true. Everything happens for a Reese's. They say everything happens for a reason, but I suspect everything happens for a Reese's. Like this commercial break. Did you need 15 seconds away from music? Or 15 seconds to eat a Reese's? Perhaps it's true. Everything happens for a Reese's.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and Talkspace, the leading virtual therapy provider, is sharing the message that connection is crucial because good relationships are an essential and sometimes overlooked component of mental well-being. If your relationships could use some strengthening, a licensed therapist from Talkspace can help. Therapy can help you communicate better with loved ones, repair conflicts, and understand how to address loneliness and build community. It's easy to sign up. Just go to Talkspace.com and you'll be paired with a therapist within 2 days. You'll meet with your therapist online on your schedule. Plus, Talkspace is in network with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. Make personal connections a priority and start today. If you're not covered by insurance, get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com and enter promo code SPACE80. That's SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com and enter promo code SPACE80.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Struggling to see up close? Make it visible with Viz. Viz is a once-daily prescription eye drop to treat blurry near vision for up to 10 hours. The most common side effects that may be experienced while using Viz include eye irritation, temporary dim or dark vision, headaches, and eye redness. Talk to an eye doctor to learn if Viz is right for you. Learn more at Viz.com.